Good morning. My name is Eric. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 15th of or January 20th. Damn, I just gave myself five extra days. Yeah. I've been up a couple hours and I'm lying. Oh God. January 20th of 2000. And I have a sponsor. He's here. And I have a home group. It's the Outlaw Safecracker Group. It's in Richmond, Virginia. See, we got a lot of heathens here from Richmond. And all my heathen friends from Alaska. Especially sick areas kind of over here. I got Chris Pick in the back holding up the D.C. contingency. It's nice. So thank you for all the people I know here and I don't know yet. It's really fun to be here, you know, and it's a great thing to be sober. I was talking to my buddy Omar. He called me, I don't know, and I was like, hey, this is the topic. What do you think I should do? And he's like, well, you probably just start off, you know, about what it used to be like when you used to wake up in the morning and unzip your front door. And I was like, all right, that's probably a good place to start. You know, when recreational camping wasn't, wasn't so recreational maybe. I don't know. So... But I guess I've been thinking about this a little. I'd be lying if I didn't. And, you know, there's two things I've primarily been thinking about. And I guess the you know, maybe emotional defeat and physical defeat would be a kind of good place to start off. And when I drank, you know, I drank for about 16 years. And, I mean, I don't know, it was a short period of time after starting to drink. I mean, I was pretty ferocious at it, you know, and I drank blackout daily, bed wet and drunk for a good part of a decade. Yes, that's right. All you bedwetters out there, you can't hide from me. That's it. Yes! It's good. So we'll get that out of the way right off the bat. And so I got used to that whole deal, and I don't know, alcohol was the most important thing in my life. And I just, nothing got in the way of it. And I didn't see that really as a defeat. You know, I just was trying to do what made sense to me in my mind and just what made me feel good and feel right and all that kind of thing. And so I just, you know, I pushed everything out of the way. And a day at a time, over a period of time, it just stopped working, you know. And in the end, I don't know what's really worse, you know. I think that is probably the worst thing. That's probably what happens to most of us is when it just, you're at a place or it doesn't really work anymore. You want it to, but it's not working. You know, and I don't know about, you know, different bottoms and all this, and I didn't come in here with a whole lot, not much of many of us do, but it's not, you know, the material or whatever that's going on. It's the emotional and the just the, I guess, alcohol not working for you and doing for you what it used to do. And I don't know why I stopped at the point. I mean, many people drank a lot longer than I did after it stopped working. I guess I'm just kind of a wussy, and so I don't know, but I was out of answers, and I didn't know what to do, you know, and I fortunately, my mom showed up at my place, and she 12-stepped me. I think she probably had tried that trick a number of times before, unsuccessfully. I wasn't ready, but at this point, there was that moment, you know, where I guess I was reasonable enough and beaten enough, and, you know, for the next few months, I tried adjusting a few things, you know, in my drinking, and it didn't work out too well, and I ultimately ended up coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. And so it's funny. I mean, I guess victory and defeat, you know, victory and defeat are one and the same in a lot of respects. And I don't know. I did not know what to do when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I spent a period of time kind of just going to a whole lot of meetings, wasn't, you know, showing up. I was showing up like at the crack of the meeting and leading right after and all that kind of thing and running around. And eventually I got a sponsor who started giving me some direction, started taking the direction, took the steps with him, and things started to change. And not too long of a period of time. I don't know. My first year of sobriety was nuts. There was a lot going on, you know. Physical sobriety is overwhelming. When you've been drinking, like we drink, a day at a time, blacking out and all that kind of stuff, you know. And I just was like waking up and my wallet was within sight, you know. I mean, there was money in it. I don't know where that came from, you know. You know, the my bills were getting paid, things were happening, and I was just like, man, this is ridiculous. And people around me were just like, what's going on, you know? And things were changing and starting to happen. And so, you know, I don't know. I was so terrified of being sober. I just didn't know what it was going to be like. That's like the thing I feel like that was the biggest roadblock, was just the fear of, what am I going to do in sobriety? You know, and even into sobriety, you get here, you're like, God, I don't even know, how am I going to ever go out to dinner? How am I going to go out with a girl? How am I ever going to, you know, communicate or go to a party? Or blah, blah, blah. You know, it's just on and on and on. And I don't know, man, all that stuff just started kind of getting kicked to the wayside, you know, and I just was following somebody else's direction about what to do. And it all just started changing for me. And I didn't know what was happening. Some things were overwhelming at first, really the physical things were, but what was happening around me, and just emotionally and spiritually, I guess, just, you know, I wasn't aware of it. My sponsor had me taking a lot of very simple actions, praying, going to meetings every day, calling him, talking to other alcoholics. I had to get a home group. I had to get a job, start shaking people's hands, you know, starting engaging with other people. I didn't like that so much. I mean, when I got here, I wasn't doing too good. I had a hard time speaking. You know, I kind of developed my own language. Like, I don't know, living in the woods in a tent, you know, will kind of wear down your vocabulary. So anyway, I was just doing the best I could, you know. And I hadn't seen a book in a long time, so it was difficult to read the literature, you know. And so I had to start doing that just a little bit, maybe a paragraph or so. And things started to kind of clear up, though, after a little bit. And I hadn't eaten a whole lot in the last few years of my drink, and I had to start eating food again. And, you know, I don't know, just a lot of things, just basic necessities of just getting along in life had to start happening for me again. And my sponsor was always quizzing me on this stuff, you know, and I just didn't really question it. I was defeated. I mean, I don't know, when I got here, I really felt like for a short period of time, I was like, I'll just come to AA meetings. And this is what you do to get sober. I just got to quit drinking. That's it. Just stop the drinking. And that's all I really need to do. That might be fine for some people who don't have alcoholism. I didn't understand the whole problem is when the drinking stops is when the crazy starts. You know, that's when we get going, you know. And anyway, so these steps were helping me in ways I didn't know, you know. And I took an inventory. It was probably one of the first, I guess, bigger surrenders, you know, that happen, you know. And I think surrenders of, hell, you could have talked, this whole meeting could have been surrenders, the same thing. So, you know, a lot of those things started having to happen for me, you know. And I think just saying yes and okay to my sponsor was the thing that got me going and starting to give stuff up. I'm not really used to doing what other people tell me to do, you know, or suggest. I've always have a plan, you know. I've had a plan since I was, since I can, far back as I can remember. Broken plan, but a plan nonetheless. And I had to kind of give that stuff up, you know, and I have to do that kind of thing today. So I started doing this, and over a period of time with my sponsor and coming to a lot of AA meetings, things just started to change in my life, you know. And I don't know, I wasn't separate from people anymore, you know, over a period of time. I was no longer, like, I was starting to not be different from everybody else. And I was so lonely when the drinking stopped. I just didn't know what to do. And I think it's probably what drove me into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, was just being lonely. And you know, I was working in a bar, and I was just, you know, leaving the bar and coming home lonely. Hell, that was happening when I was drinking anyway, so, I mean, God, so... but it was just wearing me out. That stuff started to just dissipate. I started hanging out with other alcoholics, you know, and I started feeling what we talk about as fellowship, you know, and I was a part of what was happening with people, and taking the steps had a big part to do with that. Having a home group had everything to do with that. Going out to coffee and to lunch and dinner and, you know, birthday parties and funeral. God, I went to so many funerals. He took me to every funeral possible in my first year. So I'm like, nobody's living. What's going on? God. But he's trying to show me, you know, we show up for these things, you know, it's about respect. And, you know, you just, I mean, when I was drinking, I was unable. Recently I was thinking about the family, my whole family, and I think it's just hit me how completely selfish I've been with everybody. You know, when you drink like we do, and drink like me, you know, the family sees you a couple times, is, you know, hammered, you know, at Christmas or whatever's going on. And then you see the next time hammered, you know, hanging onto the Christmas tree, whatever it is you're doing. You know, they're like, it puts a stamp in their brain of like, this is how this person is, you know. And then if they love you or whatever, they just worry about you, you know. And I'm just cashing that in. And I'm like, you know, it's none of your business. None of your damn business what I do with my drinking. If it's bothering you, it's your problem, you know. I don't even know how I got off on this topic, but anyway, just being selfish. And so that kind of thing, is, recently, I guess I've just, it's hit me just how much of a jerk I've been, especially with my mom and different people. But when you get sober and you're physically sober, you don't even have to talk about it. They see you when you're showing up. And that's why my sponsor is dragging me to, you know, all these different places, making sure I was showing up on time, doing what I would say I was going to do when I said I was going to do it. Because my family and my employers and, you know, people I was having relationships with, you know, started to notice this thing. I'm not a guy that is able to do any of that stuff when I'm drinking. I show up for drinking. I take drinking's direction perfectly without fail. Best sponsor, well, I shouldn't say the best, but it's been one of the most effective sponsors I've ever had is alcohol. I don't know why I ever hear anybody complain about taking direction. You did it for so long with the drinking, you know. And no questions asked, baby. Front of the line. I'll do what you tell me to do. And so, I don't know. I just had to give in to what people were who have been ahead of me and showing me what works for them. And probably the biggest thing about, you know, victory and defeat has been the relief of bondage of self and just being wrong. You just got to be wrong. What a gift. You know, I did not know what to do with all the anger and all of the, you know, just everything, all of just the angst that I came in here with, you know, and also all the stuff that I have seemed to have generated since I've been sober. So, and I mean, I'm just like, you know, I don't want to be resentful. It feels awful. I hate being fearful. I don't enjoy it. I'm not enjoying it. You know, I'm separated. And, you know, being wrong has been one of the best things that's ever happened. I had a situation a couple weeks ago, and I called my sponsor, and I'm like, hey, this is what I did this time, you know. And situation went south, and I decided to get even, you know. Vindictive, acting like a little kid, you know. Let somebody know exactly what time it is. And thanks, Omar, for that. And you know, as usual, didn't work out too well. You know, I talked to my sponsor. You know, I knew it's coming. And I got to clean it up. And I'm like, man, I'm not wrong. You know, I'm thinking this. I don't want to do it. But I also tell you, man, I know the other end of that, you know, of not cleaning it up. And that's just continued defeat, you know, and you just sit in it. You're just with it. You and whatever it is you're doing, you know. I mean, it's a horrible spot. And it's no, I mean, it's like you think about it, what's keeping me from being wrong? You know, my ego. And I mean, that thing just rears up. It's got a lot of power. It seems to come back. So I call this guy. I get wrong. And what had been on me for 3.5-4 hours left in about 3 minutes. You know, it's like the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous in the directions here. And I did not have any of that going on when I was drinking. I was just a guy that was just drunk, couldn't speak, and write all day long, you know, and miserable, you know, horrible. And that's just been changing. It's a wonderful thing, you know. The inventory is a wonderful thing. Being honest with another, you know, human being or several in this case, sometimes it just takes a team of people to kind of get me off the ledge. So, you know, but I have to be honest with people about stuff, and it's a wonderful thing for it to happen. And I don't know, this over-concentration of me on me, you know, the bondage of self, I didn't even know that was happening when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Again, I really thought it was just the drink. I'm just hammered. You know, if I could just stop drinking, everything's going to be just fine. That's my whole problem. I'm pretty nice. I'm a good guy, right? You know, I'm in debt. I treat you like crap, and I can't show up anywhere, but I'm good. I mean well, you know. I really mean the best. And, I mean, there just is no solving a problem unless you believe that you have a problem. I mean, there just isn't. And sometimes I have to wear some things out. I've worn out a bunch of stuff. man, I continue to wear stuff out. Things just, they show up, they leave, they show up. I know there's a power that's bigger than Eric because I'm physically sober. And sometimes, and most of the time, it's just that simple. I couldn't stop. I didn't want to stop. I should have wanted to stop. You know, if you, we had a whiteboard behind us and I'm doing little drawings of things that are happening in my life, you'd be like, yeah, Eric, why don't you just quit it? You know, a lot of people kind of took that approach. And it might make sense for a second, but it's just washed away, you know. And I don't know what's up with this whole obsession getting removed, but it got plucked at some point, you know. And then the stuff with me being selfish and whatever, it's here. It's always going to be here. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I try to help other people. I do what I'm told to do, you know, and I do what I'm shown to do. Sometimes they have to be told, you know. And hopefully that relieves this bondage of self where I'm just like, man, I don't have time for whatever this is, you know. Or I'm in defeat and I don't even know it, you know. Anyway, I think I'm going to stop. There is a lot of victory here. And if you're new, welcome. Stick around, take some direction, and have some fun. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Eric. That's wonderful. The program works. Our next speaker is Jean from North Carolina.
My name's Jean, and I am a grateful alcoholic. For those of you who know me, you know I really feel like I'm going to throw up. You know? But fortunately, it has not happened yet. I see Patty's down here shaking her head. She's known me like 25 years. She knows I feel like I'm going to throw up. But what has happened to me and what usually does happen is if I start out the way I usually start out, somewhere along the line, God takes over. And whatever is supposed to be said this morning is what's going to come out. Like Eric, I'm sure I've said this thing over and over in my head 1,000 times. I don't know whether I liked it or I didn't like it because I forgot what I said. You know, so we'll just go ahead and we'll just see what happens. My sobriety date is May the 12th, 1983. And believe me when I tell you that that is a miracle in my life. And it's a miracle in the lives of anybody who touches my own life. It's a miracle in the lives of my children. I was a drunk mother. A lot of us were drunk mothers or drunk fathers. You know, and I know when I got to making my amends, I make amends on a daily basis. I do living amends to my children because I can never, ever, ever give back what I stole. And that's what I did. I would tell you years ago that I never stole a thing. You know, until I really started to look at it and I realized that I did. You know, the promises that I made that I was going to do and then never happened because by the time it came time to do it, I was too drunk to do it. And I was probably passing out for the third or the fourth time that day because I ended up being a 24-hour-a-day drunk. I can't even say alcoholic. I have to say I was a 24-hour-a-day drunk by the time I found Alcoholics Anonymous. I had my first drink and my first drunk and my first blackout when I used to tell you when I was 15, but I know now I was 14. You know, it's amazing what the mind does to us. It truly is amazing. And I tell you that because I'll fast forward to about 2004, I think it was, when I went to a high school reunion in New Jersey and I was reunited with my high school sweetheart. And he was the one who took me on that night in June in 1953 with a group of people into New York City because we only lived about 25 miles from there. And I remember going down those stairs in that smoky room and that wonderful jazz and all that cool stuff. And I didn't know. Somebody said, "Do you want a drink?" And I didn't know. What did I know? You know, I'm whatever I was, 14. And I said, I heard somebody say 7 and 7. This is what I swear to you, folks, I really believed. And so I said, I'll take that. And the next thing I know, I woke up in my bed at home. That's what alcohol did for me. Now, when I was reunited with my high school sweetheart, and he was a widower and I had been divorced forever, and the rest, as we say, is history. And we just celebrated our 9th wedding anniversary. And he is the love of my life. I mean, it took me 3 times, guys, but You know, this one is, I mean, he is, you, I had a college roommate, every time you asked her how her husband was, she'd go, oh, David's wonderful. I thought, God, when can I say that? You know, I just want to be able to say that. But you ask me today, how's Edward? And I'll tell you, he's wonderful. But anyway, he called me one day and he said to me, you know, that story you tell is not the truth. And I said, really? And he said, well, I'm sending you a copy of what you wrote in my yearbook in 1953. Now, this is where I usually get the biggest laugh. Well, no, there's one other part where I get a big laugh. I'm looking at my wonderful sponsee over there. I wrote in his yearbook, and I have it for proof, and it's highlighted. I wrote, and furthermore, don't ever show me any more gin. I wrote, I hate the stuff. And this is the corker. I wrote, thank God I can stop now. I was 45 years old when I quit drinking. Yes, absolutely. So, and I have a sponsor. You know, we're talking about victory and defeat, and alcohol certainly did send me to the bottom of the barrel. But I think sometimes in sobriety we suffer some defeat also. And fortunately for me and for all of us in this room, I have those wonderful 12 steps that I can apply in my life. And I finally today have a network of people that I can call who understand what I'm saying. If I try to explain it to somebody out there, they think I'm out of my mind, I'm nuts, I've lost it, and what is wrong with you? You shouldn't think that way. But you know, those of us in here, I believe we think differently. I really believe we think differently. And I had a wonderful sponsor when I moved to North Carolina about almost 10 years ago now. And she was a wonderful, but she had a lot, five, six back surgeries. She had diabetes. She had a lot of things. And she died in January. And I watched her disappear in front of me. It wasn't like someone with Alzheimer's, because I know they physically don't disappear, but, you know, the mind goes. Excuse me. But I just watched her go. And I was walking into a meeting last January, and this nice little lady was walking in with me, and I've learned not to say, are you new? That I've learned. I now say, how long have you been around? You know, because sometimes people are new to the area, but not new to AA. And so I do. And she told me her name was Liz, and she was picking up 36 years of sobriety shortly. And that God thought went through my head, and I knew that once more God had done for me what I could not do for myself. And it was actually the day that Jan died that I asked Liz if she would sponsor me. And thank God. I mean, thank God. She walked in up early this morning. I said, I was just getting ready to call you. I'm going to throw up. So, no, you're not going to throw, you know. And I have so many wonderful, awesome people in my life as a result of this. But for me, that was, you know, I never liked to reach out and ask anybody for help. God forbid, you should know that I didn't know. You know, and that's what this victory over that defeat has taught me. Is like, the worst thing that can happen is somebody's going to say no to me. That's absolutely the worst thing that anybody can say. So, and I have a home group. My home group is over here. Thank you all. I love them all. I love them dearly. They are my lifeline, you know. They know me. I know them. And then, of course, I have my spiritual advisor who is ready to kick my butt, but that's okay. You know, and I love him dearly, and he does know me better than I know myself. So I have adopted all of these things in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was told that's what I was supposed to do. I think to get into my recovery, I should talk about my last drunk. My late husband and I had moved. We had been transferred around the country a lot, and of course, each time my alcoholism increased a little bit. And that 5 o'clock drink went to 4, and 4 went to 3, and 3 went to 2. And when you live in California, everybody drinks wine, so why not drink wine in the morning? Sounds like a good idea. I think I will. You know, and pretty soon, that's how I had evolved. And so my husband at this point in time, my girls were in college and my husband was traveling the world. I think he was in England, as I remember, and I had become a bar drinker. I can't tell you how it happened in the beginning, but it did. And I'm here to tell you that since I got sober, not one person from those bars has called me. You know? And I was sure that I was not going to be able to live without alcohol. How would I live without these people? You know, when you got to the bars that I got to, you didn't want to live with those people. And my morals went out the window. I sold my soul for a drink. It's the truth. That's all. It's just the truth. I'm not proud of that, but that's how I got my alcohol. Because when I was at home, I had to drink the bar scotch, and then I had to decant from the bottle in my closet, and sometimes I put too much in, and then I had to take, you know, drink it out, and it just got really hard. So it was just easier to go to the bar and have them give me a drink. You know, that was just really easy for me. So now my husband's in England, and I'm at the bar, and I moved an unemployed house painter into my house with me because it sounded like a good idea. I was drunk. You know, what did I know? That's what I did. The problem was he came home early, and he just wasn't really thrilled about what he saw. And I didn't understand that. Because truly, if you had to live like I was living, you'd have done the same thing. You talk about the insanity of the disease of alcoholism. That was it. That was absolutely the insanity of alcoholism. So anyhow, because my husband was angry, I decided I was leaving. So I took my, gold in one hand, and I took my furs in the other, and I stood at the bottom of the steps of my million-dollar house on the ocean in Seagirt, New Jersey, with two cars in the driveway and all the credit cards I wanted, and I said, I'm not going to live like this anymore. And the truth is, I haven't. And that's okay. You know, that's okay. And I can't tell you where I went on this last drunk. I have very little memory of anything, if I tell the truth, and that is the truth. I remember a big, long limousine in Hoboken, New Jersey, before Hoboken became the yuppie capital of the world. I remember some men in shiny black suits handing me a $100 bill and a bottle of scotch. I remember that. And I remember a key to an apartment on Madison Avenue. And I remember coming out of a blackout in the Bowery of New York City in 1983, and I didn't belong there. You know, I was in my Fair Isle sweater and my cords, and I really looked out of place in the Bowery, and I didn't belong there, and I didn't know how I got there. You know, and I don't know. I ended up in a motel room in New Jersey that was so sleazy it didn't have a phone. And I came to, and I had an empty half gallon of Dewars, and I had alcoholic paralysis, and I crawled on my hands and knees for 2 days, and I should have died. I didn't, but I should have. Like to believe that God had something better in store for me. I like to believe that. And I can't tell you how I got home, and I can't tell you how angry my husband was and how upset he was, and how he wrote me this letter, and he put me on a plane to Nebraska to my brother, because after all, my brother dealt with juvenile delinquents and maybe he could do something with her. But he handed me this letter, and he told me how much he loved me, but that he could neither forgive or forget my behavior, and he was suing me for divorce. And now I had no place to go. I mean, you talk about defeat. I mean, that's where alcohol took me. That's exactly where I had no place to go. I didn't have my wonderful family come out of the woodwork and say, well, you cute little thing, you've quit drinking, come live with us. You know, nobody did that. Thank God. I thank God today. I was angry then because I didn't understand why they didn't do that. But they didn't do it because they knew it wouldn't help me. You know, and I'm grateful today. God, I was angry then. I was really angry. And so I had no place else to go. My brother Neil said to me, you're really sick. I don't think you can walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and just make it. So you need to go to rehab. I said, how long is that? He said, probably 28 days. And I'll stand here this morning and I'll tell you that I was there for 4.5 months. Yeah, nobody knew what to do with me. But I came out a stronger woman. You know, I had no self-esteem. Well, I went to Alina Lodge eventually. I don't know if anybody's heard of Alina Lodge or knows of Alina Lodge. It is for the reluctant to recover. I didn't know how they knew I was reluctant. They never even let me out to try it. I mean, that's the least they could have done, but they didn't. They sent me from one 28-day program to 3.5 months. That's the way it was. I'm really grateful for that. Became one of the greatest things that ever happened to me because it was there, and that alcohol had defeated me to such a point that I had nothing. I didn't even know who I was. And there was a counselor there at Alina Lodge whose name was Cynthia. Now, I love that name because it's my second daughter's name. But, boy, this woman was a witch with a B. I mean, she really was. And I'd seen every counselor there was. And she sat me down and she looked at me and she said, "Who are you?" And I started to tell her I was a wife and a mother and, you know, whatever. And she looked at me and she said, "I did not ask you what you were. I asked you who you were." And I didn't know. I did not know who I was. But I know today, and I learned it through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know today who I am. I know that I'm honest. I know that I'm trustworthy. I know that I'm dependable. I know that, God forbid, I had to go back to work, I'm employable. You know, I'm really enjoying retirement, you know, and I'm getting old, really old. But I know all of these things about me today, and I didn't know who I was. You know, I overcame all of those defeats to find out who I was. I remember sitting at the dining table there, and Mrs. D would come around, put her hands on your shoulder. I can feel her in this room. It's really scary. And she would put her hands on your shoulders and you'd look up and she'd say, "And how are you today?" And you'd say, "Fine, thank you." And she'd say, "According to whose standards?" And I didn't know the answer for a long time. I didn't know the answer. But I know that the answer was according to my standards. You know, according to my standards. So I had to move into an apartment. I had to learn how to live all over again. I had never lived alone, ever. I went from my father's house to my husband's house. Somebody always took care of me. You know, and now I had to stand on my own 2 feet, and I had to learn how to live. Had to learn how to live through this blueprint. That's exactly how I learned how to live. I did exactly what I was told. I was told, don't drink, go to meetings. Get a sponsor, get a home group, and get active. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is not for people who want it, and it's not for people who need it. Alcoholics Anonymous is for people who do it. And when I do it, I stay sober. And when I do it, and so I did it. My first sponsor, God bless her, she had me doing service work before I knew I was doing service work. She would call me up. She would say, and I have a shirt that says this, and I meant to bring it, and I forgot. I would say, "Well, where are we going, Marge?" And she would say to me, "It's none of your business. Shut up, get in the car." And I have a shirt that says, "Shut up, get in the car," and it has the AA symbol. You know? She also told me, which I loved and was good for this mouth of the South, you know, that she told me to sit back, take the cotton out of my ears, put it in my mouth, and listen. She said, "You have absolutely nothing anyone in this room wants. And until you do, just say your name and be happy." You know? Now, some people think that that's, you know, but that's that tough love that I got sober on. I have the name in my home group and around the Greensboro area as being known as Mean Jean. I worked really hard for that. You know, because this disease is going to kill me if I give in. This disease is going to kill me. And I'm not ready to go yet. You know, I'm just not ready. And for me, it's just really important to stay sober. So when I go to a meeting to keep my sanity and to keep my sobriety, I don't want to hear about somebody's cat dying. I just don't want to hear it. I want to hear, how do you stay sober one day at a time? You know, And I also irritate people because, and another way I do, I say, how many here have a home group? Okay, there we go. Okay. How many attend the business meeting after the home group? See? You know, I always say raising my hand does not make me a member of my home group. What makes me a member of my home group is when I chair meetings and when I show up at those meetings and when I go early and I help set up and when I stay late and I help break it down. That makes me a member of my home group. Just raising my hand does not make me a member of my home group. And everybody in my home group knows I scream all the time. We have a list of members, must be 60, maybe 60 people. And we get 12 at a business meeting, you know? Are they really? I don't know. But doing all of that has helped me to stay sober. When I was about 3.5 years sober, how many? Oh, my God, I got to quit because I got to read this. I really do. I really have to read this because this is just so, this is the most important thing to me. This was given to me by a dear, dear friend of Jim's and mine and a few other people, I'm sure, quite a few years ago. I loved him. He loved me, and I know it. And so I'm going to invite everybody, just sit back and relax. Just close your eyes if you want. We're going to go on a little trip because for me, this sums up victory and defeat. And there's a note here that says, every time you read this, remember that an old country boy in Tennessee loves you. God bless you, Tom. Tucked away in our, this is called the station, tucked away in our subconscious is an idyllic vision. We see ourselves on a long trip that spans the continent. We are traveling by train. Out the windows we drink in the passing scene of children waving at a crossing, of cattle grazing, of smoke pouring from a power plant, of rows of corn and wheat, of flatlands and valleys, of mountain skylines and village halls. But uppermost in our minds is the final destination. On a certain day, at a certain hour, we will arrive at the station. Once we get there, so many dreams will come true. How restlessly we pace the aisles, damning the minutes for loitering, waiting for the station. When we reach the station, that will be it, we cry. When I'm 18, when I put the last kid through college, when I get a promotion. When I reach the age of retirement, I shall live happily ever after. Sooner or later, we must realize there is no station, no one place to arrive. The true joy of life is the trip. The station is only a dream. It constantly outdistances us. It isn't the burden of today that drive men mad. It is the regrets over yesterday and the fear of tomorrow. Regret and fear are twin thieves who rob us of today. So stop pacing the aisles and counting the miles. Instead, climb more mountains. Eat more ice cream. That's my favorite. Go barefoot more often. Watch more sunsets. Laugh more. Cry less. Life must be lived as we go along. The station will come soon enough. And I know for this alcoholic, if I don't take my sobriety seriously, God will take it away. He'll give it to someone who will. Not today.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jean. And I want to thank all the mean genes in here because if I hadn't had a mean gene in my early recovery, I don't think I'd be standing here today. Something about those mean women. Our next speaker is John B.
No way. My name is John. I'm an alcoholic. I'll give my sobriety date as well. It's some reference to the era in which I got sober. It was September 29th, 1980. And I was 24 years old. It's just in the last couple of years I don't say 24 and a half. Which was indicative of how immature I was at the time. And I'm going last, but I'm right between. I wasn't in a tent, and I wasn't in a $1 million home.
There you go.
In fact, I don't think I've ever even been in a $1 million home. But I have been in a tent and drunk, so.
There you go.
I'm really, really great, happy to be here, scared shitless, but I know you all understand. And I know my job is to give you some wisdom, so my first piece of honest wisdom I can give you is it's a lot easier to say yes to somebody in New York about speaking here than it is to climb up on this podium. I really enjoyed our speakers. You know, when you're up here on the dais, whatever it is, you're thinking, man, the order and what's the best. And I could look at it two ways. These people knocked it out of the park. They were wonderful talks, very, very succinct. What am I going to do now? All that's left is to drop the ball. But the positive part of me, the victory part of me goes, it's taken care of. Even if I drop the ball, it'll be all right. And that's exactly what my sponsor would have told me. He would encourage me before talks. Every time my wife's laughing, every time I talk about my sponsor, I get misty. But anyhow, he would always say, John, you just got to tell your story. It's the only one you got. And nobody knows it better than you. And that's not totally true, because there's a lot of gray areas in my story. Like I said, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 24 years old. I just got my third drunk driving. I came into my first AA meeting, and if I had a prayer, being an atheist and agnostic at the time, it was, let this be tolerable. I now know if it had been tolerable, I would have never stayed sober. Early on, my goal was just not to drink. And once I did that, like it's already been mentioned, this deal is a lot more about than not drinking. You will, just trying to survive and not drink, you will hit a series of bottoms that are emotional and painful, and they will drive you into the steps. And that's been my experience. What was really my experience, too, though, in those early days, before I learned all this in hindsight, is I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they practiced it in 1980 a lot more like they do in the book. They asked me to identify and not compare. They talked about what their drinking did to them, how they drank, and what happened. And that was the key. That's how I'm amazed. It's a miracle. I walked in with that attitude, let it be tolerable, and I walked out going, this might work. Because those people talked about drinking, and they drank the way I drank. They talked about the mental twist, and they put it in words that I could understand. Good times I drink, bad times I drink, get a job I drink, lose a job I drink. Whatever the situation is, I find an excuse and a reason to drink. Get out of jail, drink. And that is, you know, people outside of Alcoholics Anonymous go, that is the most insane concept in the world. You couldn't even not drink the day after getting arrested. And people inside AA go, well, of course you drank. Provided Bond didn't eat up the last bit of your money. I came to those meetings, and a group of men took me in under their wing, and they talked to me directly, and they helped put these crazy concepts of the big book into language I could understand, both about the mental twist, but more importantly, the other ways our book describes alcoholism, that once we start consuming, it sets off an allergy that no amount of willpower can get me to stop. And the way I describe it is when I break the bottle on the seal on a bottle, you can throw the cap away because I'm going to finish that baby. And I'd done that no matter what the circumstances were. If it was wise for me to go to bed by 9 o'clock because I had to get up at 6, if I started drinking, I drank until I was drunk. And they told me, if you can relate, well, the book says, a serious drinker will understand at once. They talk briefly about that part where they say, if you don't think you're an alcoholic, why don't you try some controlled drinking? They didn't even have to finish the second part. I didn't need to know what the experiment was. I knew controlled drinking had never been a part of my vocabulary. When I was 24 and I got sober, there was a fairly good young people's contingency in our area. A lot of people my age were getting sober, but nonetheless, it was rare for somebody 24 to get sober. But I'm grateful for that because it really helped me put things in perspective. They shared with me, the older members, like it says in the book, long before they knew it, their drinking was out of control. And that's the way I've shared it with newcomers ever since. We talk about raising the bottom, but I do not believe we can raise the bottom beyond the definition of alcoholism that is contained in the big book. That we have an obsession of the mind coupled with a bodily allergy. If you don't meet that criteria, this stuff probably isn't going to make sense to you. More importantly, you're not going to be willing to do the humbling acts of the other remaining 11 steps. Even having that kind of humiliation and having had an unmitigating defeat of alcoholism, a lot of us aren't real anxious to do those steps anyhow. Like I said, I was blessed similarly with sponsors that were direct, but they were kind. They would tell me, here we go. My first sponsor, Rod, would... I'll go back to another thing. You know, it says in our book... it says in our book we don't like to pronounce anyone an alcoholic. Well, I don't think Rod read that part. Because whenever I'd waver on that, maybe this wasn't for me, he'd go... Let me remind you of a couple stories you've told me. And he goes, let me remind you of how you were when you came in. And let me remind you of all the things you said when you were on a pink cloud. And the things I'd say on a pink cloud were, it would be a one in a million deal that a guy like I would be sober. I would say other crazy stuff like, they should never give me a license back. Which Rod reminded me of when I was complaining that I didn't have a driver's license and everybody else was getting theirs. And he said, well, you're the guy that said they should never give you one. So I, Rod was direct but kind, and I really believe it was divine intervention that a guy like me, a one in a million guy, would even walk into a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe it was divine intervention that I would meet Rod, who could be both kind and direct and share his experience and his hitting defeat. And most importantly, the important part, once we establish that we must have a defeat, is the positivity that there is a victory in this recovery. It is not about tolerance. It is not about tolerating. It is not about putting our fist in our pocket. It is about living, as the theme of this convention is, happy, joyous, and free. And I'm grateful for the people that have been in my life that have continued to steer me back to that. I'm grateful they taught me to stick with the winners. You know how you identify a winner? Well, it's easier to go negative than to identify the loser. And that's when you're pissing and moaning outside a meeting. And they're going, yeah, right on. Just like we used to do in the bar. And the last thing I'd like to close with, taking a look at all this, at the preceding days before this talk, I thought a lot about what it is, the defeat And I came to realize that the defeat is changes for all of us. It's circumstances. And the defeat isn't the circumstances. Because if it's your driver's license, there's ways of getting your driver's license back. If it's your boss, there's ways of getting other jobs. If it's your wife, I can tell you there's ways of getting another wife. It's not circumstances. It's the fact that I have an allergy of the body coupled with a mind that is unable to say, unaided, going and having that one drink is a bad idea. So I'm grateful for the opportunity. I appreciate all the fellowship. I appreciate you listening, and I thank you.